For the week of August 6th, 2017, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 376, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, but not for long, I'm Michael Giltz.
Michael's world tour. It's like I'm hosting the show with Dave Matthews, who never seems to be in the same place for very long because he's always on tour with his band.
Couldn't you have said Bob Dylan?
Bob Dylan, too. By the way, I don't know. I just know Dave Matthews and I guess Bob Dylan. They're constantly on tour. They never come off tour.
Willie Nelson, Bob Dylan. A lot of people you could have picked other than Dave Matthews. But anyway, yes, I'm going back on the road. I'm heading to Philly today to drop off some furniture to my niece where she's studying for her dental exam. She wants to be a dentist. Then I'm heading to Allentown, Pennsylvania to visit my brother, pick up my mail. Heading to New York City to go see theater and some Yankee games and visit my friends, and then head back down to Nashville where I'm going to see the solar eclipse.
Yes, that's right. Here in North America, we have a band across North America where you can see the solar eclipse. There's like a narrow band, and apparently hotel rooms in that band are going for like $1,000 a night the night of the eclipse.
Well, it depends on the hotel room in the city, but yes, rates have gone up. So I'm making it out of state, but Sperling, you made it out of the house. That's pretty good.
Yes, I made it out of the house, and I went to see The Cake by Becca Brunstetter. This is a play, and Michael, you know I go to all of these offbeat black box theaters in Los Angeles whenever I can, because that's where a lot of young playwrights and up-and-coming playwrights get to, their first plays are produced, and you get to, you know, see young talent and up and coming talent.
That's right. But Becca is not exactly a find. She's a writer on This Is Us. She's a writer on American Gods. She's got a big profile. A month ago, she was profiled in the New York Times.
Yeah. So I didn't know any of that. I just heard, the Echo Theater group that you like to go see plays at every once in a while. Yeah, their latest production is supposed to be pretty good. So I went to buy tickets. They were all sold out. So I had to use this like app called Today Ticks to get one ticket day of, and I was like, wow, this thing is really popular. I should have probably looked it up, and it was a great play. But you're right, the playwright writes for This Is Us. I mean, she's now a well-known playwright.
Yeah, The Cake has got a hot button storyline about a woman in the South who's marrying another woman, and a good friend of the family makes cakes. She's a baker, and she asks her to bake the cake for her wedding, and the woman feels uneasy about it.
Right.
And it's also a mixed marriage, two women. It's very exciting, but it's gotten really good reviews. It's being produced all over the country, and I'm sure at some point soon it will make it to New York.
Well, yeah, I mean, in 1 year, all of a sudden there's 6 or 7 productions. In fact, while The Echo was trying to produce the world premiere, somebody produced it before them. That's how fast.
Well, usually you have understandings and rules about who gets to do what. You can't just, beat someone to it. You know, so it's, I'm sure there was, everybody knew what was going on there.
Yes, and just to tweak what you said a little bit, the play is really about the cake baker who is in her, like, 50s or 60s. And then her, the woman getting married comes from New York back down to the South with her fiance, who happens to be a woman. So
that's right.
Yeah.
Well,
it's a great
Becca's play. Having a great week because her show opened in LA. You liked it. Now she's at the top of the show on Showbiz Sandbox. So if she keeps listening, what else will she hear about?
Well, we're going to tell you how some big name players in Hollywood are growing increasingly frustrated with Hollywood accounting practices and exactly what they plan on doing about it. That's what we're going to discuss on this week's show. Sylvester Stallone, for instance, is suing Warner Brothers over profit participation for his 1990s hit movie Demolition Man. And the court, by the way, has so far been siding with him. While no longer retired filmmaker Steven Soderbergh is taking the distribution of his latest movie into his own hands, during our book filter segment, Michael will talk about a string of books that would make great properties for anyone looking to create movies focused on women. You know, the people who buy the majority of movie tickets and have veto power on dates? On Inside Baseball, we'll tell you how more and more people are growing fed up with high cable bills and what they're doing about it. Some millennials have even discovered an amazing hack to get the broadcast networks for free, and it's legal, we'll explain. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world, because if you just looked at box office in North America, all the news is bad. Three movies opened up poorly: The Dark Tower, Kidnapped, starring Halle Berry, and Detroit, Imagine that. An art house film with mixed reviews doesn't work well when you expand it to 3,000 screens. But if you look at the box office around the world, the news is great, at least for one big movie. We've got a link to ComScore in our show notes. We pull information from Box Office Profit and Mojo, Variety, The Hollywood Reporter, and the number one movie around the world for the second week in a row is Wolf Warrior 2. Last weekend, it opened up huge in China and four other territories. This week, it expands just one territory to the United Kingdom, but its box office grows. So now this movie has gone from a big, big box office smash into an absolute phenomenon. It grossed $163 million over the weekend. It's at $470 million worldwide. It's only been out for 2 weeks. And after 3 weeks, one more weekend of box office, Wolf Warrior 2 will become the highest grossing Chinese film of all time. It will pass The Mermaid from 2016 to become the biggest Chinese hit both in that country and worldwide of all time. And it's barely even stopped. I mean, it's just getting going. Well, so this is really a big, big hit.
And to give you some sense as to just how big a hit this is, keep in mind what the prices for a movie ticket are in China. They're not exactly the same price as in North America or Europe. It's around $5.30, the average movie ticket. And yet, even with that, okay, on Sunday, yesterday, the film earned $62 million in one day after 11 days. It's been out 11 days already, and it's still earning, you know, $60, $50 million in a day.
Wow. So it stars Wu Jing, a.k.a. Jackie Wu, who is a martial artist who's turned into a film star a la Bruce Lee and Jackie Chan and a host of other big stars in Asian cinema. So he's obviously become a big name. We pointed out how it defeated the official government propaganda film, which is called, what is it called? The Founding of a Nation
or something.
The
like
Founding
that.
Of an Army.
Yeah.
But this movie is no slouch when it comes to the jingoism category, by the way. I didn't realize this, but this movie is very nationalistic. It turns out the mercenaries that our hero is defeating are American mercenaries in part. And the tagline for the movie, according to the BBC, is "Anyone who offends China will be killed, no matter how far the target."
Okay.
Which isn't exactly catchy, but it does make me want to point out that I love the CPC, and if I could register for the Communist Party here in the U.S., I would, and Sperling is a capitalist running dog. But anyway, moving on.
By the way, if you want to see the first movie, it's on Netflix. I just looked it up. It's on Netflix. I might see the first movie, then go try and find a theater here in the U.S. to see the sequel.
Well, it's playing in the U.S. on a number of screens. The first movie, this movie is apparently a big improvement on the first one. It's apparently, you know, like a First Blood Rambo type thing. It's got some good stuff. But everybody says Wolf Warrior 2 is an improvement, at least in the action scenes, in every possible level. It still sounds like it's a pretty thin blockbuster type movie. I don't think it's a great film a la, say, Crouching Tiger. It's clearly not that. But it is a box office phenomenon. $470 million after two weekends, going really strong, and it's about to become the biggest Chinese hit of all time. And number two around the world is another big hit, Dunkirk, from director Christopher Nolan. $42 million on the weekend, $315 million worldwide. The budget for that movie is said to be $100 million. And so now it's tripled that at the box office and still doing quite well. This is certainly a movie that will be up for Oscar consideration. So whether they re-release it or get out on DVD and Blu-ray by then, it's going to be a big player. And number three is another Chinese film. Wolf Warrior 2 is not the only story in China. It's not sitting there unopposed. This is a big period for Chinese movies. They have a summer blackout going on right now, which means no international films are opening up. It's just Chinese movies opening. And a big one has just opened. It's called Once Upon a Time. It's a romantic fantasy about goddesses becoming mortal and falling in love and then becoming a goddess again. It's romantic, it's dramatic, and it grossed $38 million on the weekend. It's made $62 million so far, so I'm guessing it opened on a Wednesday. I'm not sure what's going on there, but it opened Wednesday or somehow last weekend and we didn't track the numbers. But it's at $62 million and had a great, you know, $38 million on the weekend. So I'm thinking that's probably a Wednesday or Tuesday opening, something like that. And number four is The War for the Planet of the Apes, $37 million on the weekend, $280 million worldwide. And at number five is a new movie opening up in North America and a couple other territories. It's The Dark Tower, the beginning of what they hoped would be a franchise, $27 million on the weekend. It's number one at the box office in North America, but, you know, reviews were very poor. Audiences seem to be falling away from it very quickly. It's not a good start for the movie. However, The LA Times says this movie cost $60 million. They say it was shot in South Africa, and they say it cost $60 million after production incentives, which always drives me nuts.
This is The Dark Tower you're referring to.
Yes, the movie we're talking about, The Dark Tower.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, I hate when they say, well, with production incentives. So they want you to know, we spent more money, but then we got it back. It doesn't matter. You know, if you spend $60 million, you spend $60 million. You moved to a certain country to do it because it was cheaper. We don't care. You spend $60 million, but it's worth $80 million. We don't care. If you get the money back, you haven't spent it. So don't tell me production incentives, because that's just a given. That's not part of the budget, because you didn't spend it.
Well, it used to be that you would do that to say, look, we have an $80 million. We have a movie that looks like $80 million up on the screen.
Right.
Now it's more like, hey, guess what? You know, you spent $60 million. You should be happy if you get back your, you know, $80 or $90 million. And so you don't want to be saying that you spent $80 million because you may not make that back.
But that still seems like an awfully low amount for a movie that looks pretty big and elaborate. $60 million? I don't care that you shot in South Africa. I question that budget being reported. However, the other question is, will they continue to make a TV series? They've just hired a showrunner, the guy who was fired from The Walking Dead in season 3. He's going to be the showrunner on a TV series version of The Dark Tower. And they're saying, what's next for The Dark Tower's cinematic universe? Dear God, people, you've just had one movie. It opened poorly. And you're talking about the cinematic universe.
Well, you know, part of the reason they do that is to get people into the theater. Like, I better see the movie when it's in movie theaters. Otherwise, you know, when the TV show starts, I'll have to catch up.
Yeah, they have the cast signed up. Idris Elba, Dennis Haysbert, and the kid from the movie, Tom Taylor, are all attached to a TV series, and they have Glenn Mazzara to be the showrunner. Their plan is to pitch a 10 or 13 episode arc to a streaming service. Nobody's attached. Nobody has said they want to do it yet, but they're all excited about launching the series. Will it happen now? I don't know. They've got the people signed up. I guess if they can get someone to say, well, it's worth 10 episodes. But I don't know. With the taint of the movie, it certainly doesn't look well.
And I'm about to show you that I did not see the movie, nor do I know the properties that well, because I'm wondering whether Matthew McConaughey would sign on for a 13-episode series. You know, it's limited. You don't have to commit to years at a time. Of course, that would require that his character make it through the first film.
Well, this film is sort of it's a mishmash post, like beyond the end of the series. So now the TV show will be sort of the background, the backstory leading up to the movie. So the man in black is the gunslinger is Idris Elba. The man in black is Matthew McConaughey, whatever they call him, the devil-like figure. He certainly will be a character in the show, but they didn't mention Matthew McConaughey being signed up.
Okay.
So who knows about all that? I just can't imagine you're going to rush to make the TV show, or anybody's going to want to, Netflix is going to want to say, yeah, we'd love to spend $40 million on that. Not after that opening. At number 6 is Despicable Me 3, another $26 million. That's at $880 million. They still could hit $1 billion worldwide. At number 7 is a Korean film. It's called A Taxi Driver. $25 million on the opening weekend. A great start for that movie, because we think it cost about $13 million. And it's a true story about a taxi driver and a German journalist who was covering the democratization movement in Korea. And the taxi driver helped him get to where he needed to go. It's a heartwarming story, I'm sure. At number 8 is The Emoji Movie. $25 million on the weekend. $62 million worldwide. Spider-Man Homecoming keeps scoring some money. That's about to hit $700 million worldwide. Valerian and the City of 1,000 Planets. That's opened up now in a few more territories. So it made $13 million on the weekend, and it's at $80 million worldwide. But it does have a lot of territories to go.
And when you look at just the U.S., you know, STX bought it for like $4 million, okay, for the U.S. So it bought the
That's
US.
All they paid for the U.S. for a $180 million movie?
Yeah.
With $4 million?
Again, it's just the U.S., just
but
the
that's
US.
$4 million. That's the biggest market in the world, and they only paid $4 million for a $180 million movie. Why would they sell it so cheap?
Well, this was exactly why the Variety, listen to me, the Hollywood Reporter was going over these numbers to say, you know, even though we all think this is a turkey and it didn't do very well, there are some people that aren't going to lose their shirt with the decision to say yes to this movie, STX being possibly one of them, because it's made $36 million here in the U.S. Let's say they paid $5 million for it and spent another $5 marketing it.
That's, not five.
Well,
that was a much bigger sell than that. I had to be at least 20.
Well,
come on, that's a big movie.
Well, then let's say they spent 20. Okay, so that's $25 million. They've made 36. They're going to be okay.
They've made 17.
According to 36 since it opened domestically.
Right. So they've actually made $18 million.
Potentially, yes. I mean, of course.
Right. They get about half back.
Right.
So yeah, no, absolutely. But if they paid $5 million, they must have guaranteed a big marketing budget. Because
yeah,
that
I'm
wouldn't
sure.
make any sense otherwise.
There's I'm sure no, that's you know, true.
Yeah, but boy, nobody wanted to go near that movie if that's all they could get. So yeah, we you know, to believe them, they say, oh, we sold it all off. We made money already in pre-sales. Like, I'd like to see the books. At number 11 is Atomic Blonde, the Charlize Theron, James McAvoy movie. What a talented actor James McAvoy is. $13 million on the weekend, $45 million in counting. Girls Trip. That was the movie on a double bill at the drive-in. I went to see Atomic Blonde, and the double bill was Atomic Blonde and Girls Trip. That also made $13 million on the weekend. That's at $90 million, a big, big success story for all involved. Cars 3 keeps chugging along, but that's at $285 million worldwide. Not good. Transformers The Last Night, that's a little bit below $600 million. That's also pretty weak. Baby Driver is a good story, $150 million worldwide. And then there's Detroit. Detroit opened to $7.2 million on the weekend in North America.
Not good.
Not good. And the reviews were poor. Pretty mixed if you look at them. But somehow the Rotten Tomatoes score is 90%.
I don't get that.
Or 88%. Well, it's because it's just a pure up and down. People want to be polite. They give it 2.5 out of 5 stars. Well, you know, it's noble. It's important. They don't want to say it's awful, but it's not a good movie. If you look at the actual reviews, you can see a string of them. Imperfect, imperfect, imperfect. That word appears like 6 times. The New York Times didn't make it a critic's pick. Variety and the Hollywood Reporter had very mixed things to say about it. If you go up and down the list, there were a lot of very negative reviews for that movie, and that's why Rotten Tomatoes is a horrible metric, especially for an art film where they want to be polite.
Well, you know, speaking of art films, okay, so we're looking at these budgets, right? And it's something, you know, something just stuck out at me. The Big Sick, and I know this is a movie we've talked about, so I'm not going to talk about the movie. Yes, it's good. Yes, go see it. But you have $12 million down here. And by the way, I know where you got that. $12 million. But you look at that and you go, wait, their budget, their operating, you know, their production budget was not $12 million. It was picked up by Amazon for $12 million. But
right.
Their budget.
So that's what it cost the people who was releasing it.
Yeah, but it's like.
You just made a big point of saying STX paid $5 million to release that movie in North America and to talk about how they made money. So if you want to talk about whether the studio that picked up The Big Sick is going to make money, you got to talk about what they paid for it. We're lucky enough to know because it was at a film festival.
Right.
And the amount they paid is public knowledge. So it's pretty firm. It's more firm than most of the budgets we quote.
That's true. Yeah, I guess I look at that. And
they tripled their budget so far, and they're going to be an Oscar contender. So they're doing great.
Yeah, and I guess I say that because somebody was telling me like how difficult this movie was to make. And I'm like, what are you talking about? They had Judd Apatow as the producer. They were going to get the money for this movie. Yeah. and then they're like, oh, but then it was really hard to get it out. I'm like, you mean because after its first screening, it got into a bidding war where it basically made $12 million? You know, it was picked up. How was that difficult? It was picked up after its first screening for multiples of what it cost to make.
Well, I'm sure on paper it was not an easy sell. But Judd Apatow helped make it happen. Talented people were involved. They made it for love, and it's paid off for everyone involved.
And worth seeing, go see it.
All right. Skipping down the list a bit, there's a Bollywood movie that opened up. Jab Harry Met Sejal.
Wait a second. I see some intellectual property infringement going on here.
Actually, it's a Bollywood romantic comedy that is not a remake of When Harry Met Sally. It's just a tribute. They're not tipping their hat to When Harry Met Sally, paying their respects, but it is not modeled on that film's storyline. So it's just a cute thing. It opened at $2.4 million and kind of mixed reviews. They put it out a week early because they're worried about next week's Bollywood movie called Toilet, which is a movie about indoor plumbing, which actually is a big issue in a lot of parts of the world, but it is a comedy of sorts, and we'll have to see how that movie, to keep your eyes out for Toilet. If it does well, you can skip all the jokes you might want to make. But here's another little detail that caught my eye. When they were going back and forth on when to open this movie, they've ultimately opened it up in Dubai and the UAE on Thursday morning. They were going to open it only on Friday night because they were worried about pirates and stuff like that. But they ultimately decided to open it up back on Thursdays. But to typically in Dubai and UAE, they open it up in the morning. In North America, they open it up Thursday nights for a lot of movies.
Right, right.
But in these countries, they open it up. They don't know, why are we waiting? Open it, start it at 11 a.m., you know? So that was sort of an interesting detail. So there are different patterns all over the world. If your country has an unusual pattern for when you open up a movie, you just want us to know, yeah, we open up on Thursdays as well for a Friday movie, let us know.
Yeah, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter, where you can leave us a message. You can reach out there. At Showbiz Sandbox is our Twitter handle. And you can like us on Facebook and send us messages on Facebook. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox and our page should come up. That's what Eric Franklin did, actually. And his email was rather long, but really the gist of it was he was saying, look, guys, you did a good job with, you know, we kind of talked about the Dali and Wanda group and how the Chinese government was kind of coming down hard on them, trying to say, hey, you're over-leveraged, right? And you could bring down our banking sector because you're so over-leveraged, even though that's kind of an exaggeration. But he said, look, all of that being true, keep in mind that Wang Jianlin, the head of Wanda, is actually the richest man in China. So when the government, and specifically Xi Jinping, is going after him, he's doing it in a way that it's meant to set an example for all of the other kind of
oligarchs.
Yes, saying, hey guys, you know what? I can get at anybody. So it's
behave.
Not, yes, it's not just about like, hey, you may have borrowed too much money to buy all these properties outside of China. It's more like, hey, I'm watching, and I'm watching you, Mr. Big Shot.
You're not in charge. We're in charge.
Right.
That, which is why I'm a member of the CPC. Yes, and if you know what Tea Guardians is, a movie that opened up this weekend, I'm not sure. I thought it might be that Russian superhero movie, but it makes no sense based on the numbers we have because it looks like this movie, whatever it is, just opened up this weekend. And that movie that I'm thinking of, Guardians, not Tea Guardians, but Guardians, opened up earlier this year and should have more box office, even if it opened up in a new territory. So if you know what Tea Guardians is, you know, also email us. And one more movie to talk about, and that's Wonder Woman.
What?
It made $2.3 million this weekend. It's at $775 million worldwide. Great for it, right? We've talked about what a big hit it is. I don't think we've emphasized how big a hit this movie is. And let's keep in mind, we get so used to movies, it made $775 million worldwide. That's a lot of money. You know, we're just getting so used to these big numbers, we just roll past them and don't think about it. This movie is the biggest single superhero movie to open since Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man back in 2002. It's bigger than all the Marvel movies, but the opening for a film. Bigger than the first Thor, bigger than the first Iron Man, Captain America, Hulk, you name it, Guardians of the Galaxy, Doctor Strange. It's not bigger than the Avengers, but that's like four or five superheroes rolled up in one. It's bigger than all the DC movies.
Is it bigger than Captain America? And there's a reason I'm asking that.
The first Captain America, substantially, that one made like 350 or 400 million worldwide.
Okay.
So this is a really big movie. It's also huge in North America. It's at $400 million. It could, if it can scrape out another $9 million, it will be the 20th biggest film of all time in North America, passing a host of other superhero movies. So this is a really big film.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is that, and the reason I asked about Captain America is, you know, AMC this past week, the largest movie theater chain in the country, and the world, by the way, they kind of said, hey, you know, we are, you know, here's our results, not only for this quarter, Q2, but here's some advanced guidance. We're not going to make as much money this year. We're going to start cutting some costs. We're going to start doing some stock buyback. By the way, our stock went from $32 a share down to like 15. So we've lost, 50% of our value this year alone. And one of the reasons they said was poor movies starting around April or May. They kind of pointed it out as April or May.
And saying it's not going to get better until like December.
Right. They said, by the way, Q3 this year will probably be off at least 15%. And somebody brought up Wonder Woman. They said, hey, what about Wonder Woman? You know, that movie's such a big hit and everybody loves it. And they said, yeah, we're really happy about Wonder Woman. By the way, if you're looking year over year, Captain America made like $1.2 billion last year during that time period.
That wasn't the first one, Captain America
movie.
We're talking about the debut movie.
Yes, no, I agree. Yes, I understand. And that's why I asked about Captain America. Because I said, well, how did it go from like earning $300 million to $1.2 billion? Frankly, I would have called Captain America Civil War Avengers 2 because it had, it had like all of the Avengers in it. So what's the point?
Oh, absolutely, it did. Yes. So AMC, so this new head of AMC who doesn't have a lot of experience in the film industry.
No,
is he just being realistic and smart, or is he creating bad will for him in the movie studios and talking down his stock?
Well, I think he's trying to talk up his stock because that is his goal. He's about to buy $500,000 of it with his own money as a way to show, hey, I believe in this business. He's been in the movie theater business for 19 months now. Before that, he was the head of the Philadelphia 76ers, an NBA basketball team. Before that, he basically turned around Vail, the big ski company that owns.
Okay, but what's he doing here? Is he being smart or is he being stupid?
I think he is being smart, but I'm wondering if, you know, maybe saying that, you know, all of the movies coming out in the third quarter are so bad that we're not going to make any money he did pawn it off on, look, all the prognosticators. He didn't say this is me talking. All the prognosticators say that it will be off at least 15%. So he could at least kind of disown the comment. But if I were the studios, I'd be a little upset that he's out there like trash talking my third quarter releases.
But the way to say it is, you know what? Last year was the biggest grossing year of all time.
Which he
did
say.
The year before that was the second biggest grossing year of all time. So you people need to wake up. And if we're the fifth biggest grossing year of all time this year, you can't say, oh, what a disaster for the film industry. You can't expect every year to make more than the year before. That's insane. So, you know, keep it in perspective. And a year ago, Captain America Civil War made all that money. It also cost a lot more than Wonder Woman, which only cost $150 million to make. So they're both winners at the box office, and we're happy about that, and we're excited about the movies coming up, but don't have unreasonable expectations.
Well, and I think he didn't go as far as what you just said, but he did point out, he said, look, for the last 5 years, we were doing gangbusters at the box office, one record-setting year after another, and the reality is, this year, things started to turn a little bit at the box office. We're making money in other territories. Europe is doing incredibly well for them. And certain films are doing better in Canada than they are in the US, even though they have no theaters in Canada. And I guess a lot of analysts, and this is all stock related, right? This is all business and investment related. You know, they're looking at AMC and going, gee, guys, you did two $1 billion deals in 2016. Plus, you went off and bought the Nordic Group. So you've basically spent nearly $2.5 to $3 billion in the space of 18 months. It's great for you, but at some point, you're leveraged to the hilt at this point. You got to delever, and your income is going down. And oh, by the way,
Some reason to think those were bad business deals? Were they overvalued, or will the Nordic Cinema Group be doing just fine?
There's some question about the Nordic Cinema Group will be doing just fine. Odeon, everybody believes, will be doing just fine. A lot of people are wondering, why did you buy Carmike Cinemas just to buy cinemas in areas where you didn't have cinemas? Because those were low-performing cinemas to begin with. By the way, we're getting this information from you. You said they were low-performing cinemas, and guess what? This quarter, they performed incredibly poorly. When will that turn around? Adam Aaron had to explain, we think by the middle of 2018, those theaters will have been...
They'll upgrade them up and all that sort of stuff.
Right, exactly.
So it's analysts thinking quarterly and a company thinking perhaps long-term.
Perhaps, yes. Yes, that is effectively correct. Yeah. And, right. and by the way, he also had to say, I don't know how much money Wanda has. We've never had to dip into it because...
Good
you know,
him, yeah.
we're a separate company.
Well, not that separate. So anyway, it's not easy running an exhibitor company. It's not easy running a studio, but everybody thinks they can do it better, including us and including director Steven Soderbergh.
That's right. You know, so Steven Soderbergh, as we all know, he is the former filmmaker because, of course, he's retired, right, Michael? He's definitely
mm-hmm.
retired.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He's retired.
Yeah. And except then, what's the name of this screenwriter, this Rebecca...
Well, don't get into that. We don't know who that is.
Yeah, we don't know who the screenwriter is, but he was given this script by some unknown screenwriter, Steven Soderbergh. And he said, wow, I like the script. I want to make it. except I want to make it my way. So he went out and raised money. Okay. He went out and got a cast, a kind of a A-level cast, some big...
Not kind of. An yeah. A-level cast.
Yeah, an A-level cast.
Channing Tatum, Daniel Craig, introducing Daniel Craig. That's the trailer. Very funny.
And he said, look, guys, if you work for scale, okay, we can give you bigger back-end participation. And oh, by the way, you'll get it because we're not selling the movie to some studio who's going to take all the profits and say, you didn't make any money. We're just going to distribute this ourselves. So,
right, so there's an article in the New York Times about how they're reinventing how to release movies. They're going to do it for scale. The actors will collaborate. They'll all go in on it and they'll profit if it makes money.
Well, he's producing the film. That's not new at all, as you pointed out during our conversation yesterday, Michael.
Well, and he's also going to distribute himself and he's going to be in charge of the advertising, which even when it's a studio film, he says, I don't have any control over the ads. I can give my input, but they basically do what they want. He can do the trailer the way he wants. He doesn't have to test it. So he's like, I'm in charge. And they're like, it's brilliant. It's never been done before. And I'm like, except for 100 years in Hollywood, people always say, we're going to do it better. You know, from United Artists back in the early 1900s right up to today, people always say, we can do it better. They're screwing us over and we're going to make sure we get all our money.
Well, you know, when we talked yesterday, I hadn't actually read the entire piece. And I got up to the part where I was like, I agree with Michael. This is basically, you know, independent film production where you go off and you sell the rights. You make people do it for scale and they get it back in, which they never actually get. Right.
So in the case they will.
Well, what he's doing differently. And by the way, it may not work. OK, he's trying to do a wide release. So he's not trying to do like, oh, two movie theaters here, two movie theaters.
Oh, no. This is a big commercial film.
Right. The name of the film is Logan Lucky. And just if we hadn't said it, but he wants to go in and get this movie into 2,500 locations. But rather than give the film to a studio where they basically get 15% of total ticket sales and they have a certain budget, usually it's, you know, $10-15 million. You kind of mentioned that, Michael, previously, you know, earlier in the show. You know, the problem is as ticket sales start being made, you have the distributor, whether it's Warner Brothers or Paramount or Lionsgate, skimming money right off the top. And then the people who, you know, made the film.
Well, skimming, that makes it sound illegal. They're charging a fee for their services.
Correct.
If in fact they haven't just outright bought the film and they're just distributing it for you, they charge for their services.
And expenses.
Of course, and expenses. Like, oh, we've got this big back lot here. We need to charge you a few bucks for that. And Soderbergh says, you know what? I think they waste too much money on advertising too far in advance of a movie's opening. I don't think you should be advertising a movie 4 weeks or 6 weeks or 8 weeks out. I think most of the money should be spent literally like the week the movie's coming out. That the week before, the weekend before, leading up to that, you know, 7 days before that Thursday opening, that's when you should do your advertising. So that's what he's going to do. He's going to spend less money, but he's going to concentrate it all on a big pile of chips, you know, bet it on black to do 1 week right before the movie opens. It's also a movie about ripping off a racetrack during a NASCAR event. So it's very much geared to the heartland. So he's going to open this movie wide. It's a comedy. It's going to open up in the heartland. It's going to open up everywhere. It's not geared towards the elites. That's for sure. Although he hopes he's getting good reviews and he'll hope, you know, smart people will go too. But this is a very commercial film and he's got a new way of advertising. He thinks it's smarter. He can do it for less money and they're going to make the profits, right? His friends can trust him that when the movie grosses a certain amount of money, they're going to get their fair share, right?
Well, because if he wants those people to come back and work for him again, yeah, he better pay them. And what he's saying is, look, even if we have a $15 million opening, that one $15 million comes to us. It doesn't go through a studio. It goes to Bleecker Street. They're getting a $1 million flat fee to do all of this. By the way, Dan Filmon, the former head of worldwide distribution at Warner Brothers, is the consultant on this. So he is basically helping Bleecker Street and Soderbergh do this. Now, the question is, could I do this? Could you do this, Michael, with your film? We're not name brands, right? Soderbergh is a name brand. So, yeah, he might be able to pull this off. I don't know.
But can he do it 20 times a year?
Right. And by the way, he's doing it with a $20 million marketing budget. So they raised $20 million on a $30 million film to do this. So it's a $50 million film all in.
Right. So if it opens to $15 million, they get $7.5 million back.
Right.
Right. So, you know, they'll see what happens. You know, I'm rooting for them. I like people taking a gamble and rolling their own dice and doing stuff. You know, Stanley Kubrick was obsessed with distribution and how movies were distributed around the country and which theaters did better and which did worse and how to do it and when. So, you know, there's a long history of interesting filmmakers getting involved in this stuff. Why not? But the funny thing is, the most radical part of the whole idea might be that the actors trust him, that if the movie makes money, they're going to get their payday, because that's something you really can't trust in Hollywood.
Well, that is very true, actually, because just ask, you know, Sylvester Stallone, who, by the way, he's having a good week. First, he booked a guest starring spot on the red-hot NBC drama This Is Us, which, by the way, is the second time we've mentioned that show on today's episode. Second, the courts refused to toss out Stallone's lawsuit against Warner Brothers, and worse for the movie studio, Warner Brothers, the court is also prepared to let Stallone focus on their accounting practices and how the studio is likely to deceive others, including the public and profit participants. In short, all of Hollywood's nonsense claiming that, you know, hit films like Harry Potter and TV shows are losing money could come to an end if Stallone's lawsuit is successful. It all revolves around the accounting on the film, believe it or not, get this, Michael, Demolition Man. Okay, when Stallone insisted he was owed money, Warner Brothers said, okay, fine, here's a check for $2.82 million, go away, you should be grateful. Stallone said, well, you know, actually, I'm going to file a lawsuit, and that's where we stand right now.
What I find fascinating about this is that it's about Demolition Man. It's not about something like the Harry Potter movies where you go, how can they possibly say the movie hasn't made money? Or a movie that cost $2 million and grossed $100 million, and you say, that's absurd. Everybody knows it's absurd. This is a movie that cost about $60 million to make, and it grossed $160 million worldwide. It was in between the era with VHS fading and DVDs were just on the horizon. So it was making good money on VHS. You know, that was still a big market, but it was not the era where they were printing money in terms of DVD and Blu-ray sales. But, you know, it's a big business. It's a very typical movie. It's not an unusually successful one. And yet Stallone has said, I know this has made money. I know you owe me money and I want my money.
Right. And basically, if this goes to trial, it's not going to.
But he has every incentive to. He doesn't need the money, right? That's the great point you made. Talk about the three suits that are going on right now.
Yeah, okay. So that's actually true. When we were prepping the show, I kind of argued the folks from This Is Spinal Tap, Harry Shearer among them, Rob Reiner, they are suing the studio, and I think it might even be, I can't remember, it might be Warner Brothers, I don't know, saying, look, we've received $5 in 20 some odd years for this movie. We know you made more money than that because the film cost $5 billion to make and it's a perennial hit. Okay. You hear about it being talked about all the time. It's on television all the time. This is a hit film and you're not giving us our profit participation. They have literally no incentive to settle. And here's why. They don't care. They don't need the money. They're doing this specifically to get this to court so that there is a jury verdict. They're trying to set precedent.
The budget on This Is Spinal Tap was a reported $2 million, and it grossed in its initial box office $4.7 million. So it's practically in the black just from the box office alone.
Right. So they're saying you made money. The Walking Dead lawsuit, Frank Darabont, he might be more inclined to settle because, you know, his agency, Creative Artists Agency, is involved. There's a whole lot of moving parts to that lawsuit.
But they could make a lot of money in a lot of different ways if they win. And his argument is that you're self-dealing, which is a big problem in Hollywood now. A studio sells a TV show to its own cable channel and sells it to its own DVD distribution company and charges itself less money or more money so that it can end up not making a profit, but somehow make a lot of money.
Right, and you'd think that self-dealing would have been done after David Duchovny's lawsuit against Fox for The X-Files, which, by the way, David Duchovny won. You would think that that would be over with, but no, the studios say, well, no, it's over with for you, Mr. Duchovny, but we're still going to do it to all of our other contracted players.
So we have a low-budget movie that had a really long shelf life in home video and elsewhere called This Is Spinal Tap. We have a TV show that was a massive worldwide hit. It is a huge monster. It was the biggest show on American TV for a year or two, bigger than Game of Thrones. And we have a feature film that was sort of just a typical old film. It did quite well at the box office. It almost tripled its budget, but it's not something that's remarkable in terms of people still talking about it the way like Spinal Tap was, nor was it a massive hit when it came out. It was a perfectly good, solid double that should have made everybody money. So that's three different kinds of properties, two or three different ways of talking about where they hid the money. And if any of them can come to fruition, it will have a big impact.
Yes, the question is, you know, will any of them actually make it that far? I think Stallone and the This Is Spinal Tap group, they have no incentive to settle unless right. a judge says, look, they're offering you $1 billion to settle. You have to take it. This is
to
ridiculous.
Which I would say, no, you need to set precedent because clearly they're trying to hide something. So, yeah, let's keep our fingers crossed that they say, you know what, we want to go to court because that'll be a lot of fun.
Well, yeah. And if they do, and the same thing, by the way, if Soderbergh is successful, if any one of these lawsuits is successful, I am sure years from now, after it's all over and the dust is settled, somebody will write a book about it.
That's right. And I think, by the way, that's a good segue, but Soderbergh very well could be successful with this movie. That doesn't reinvent the wheel, but there will be a book about it, won't there?
Yes, which means it's time for our Book Filter segment. Book Filter is a book lover's best friend, and every week Michael picks a few new releases for us, which are they're ready to be optioned or turned into TV shows or movies. What have you got for us this week, Michael?
Well, you know, people want to close the gender gap. They want more female directors. They want more properties focused on women in the movies or television. And there's a couple great books out this week, but I imagine they'll pass them all by. One is The Book of Emma Reyes, which is a memoir about a woman growing up in extreme poverty in Colombia, which doesn't sound very promising, but it's been hailed as an instant classic in that country. Gabriel Garcia Marquez encouraged the author when she was alive. And people love stories about people suffering when they're kids. They love it. You know, Angela's Ashes, you name it. There's Life in Code by Ellen Ullman. She's a major figure in the tech world. This is her second book, sort of a memoir. It's about her life in the tech world. And if you combine this with her classic Close to the Machine, you can really tell the story of this era from the 70s on in the tech industry from a unique, fresh perspective. I imagine you've heard of Ellen Ullman and know her.
Yes.
Yes.
Not and personally, but yes.
Right. And in a third book, which I think is really fascinating, is called Because of Sex. And it's the history of women fighting for gender equality via the Civil Rights Act, which made it illegal to discriminate, quote, because of sex. The book covers 50 years and 10 cases of women doing just that, fighting for their basic rights, from a woman denied an assembly line job because she had a kid, to a woman who wanted to become a prison guard, which was supposed to be a man's job, to a woman denied partnership at a Big Eight accounting firm, right up to the most recent case, you probably remembered, a UPS driver who was forced to take an unpaid leave when pregnant because she asked for a temporary reprieve from lifting heavy boxes. That could be a documentary, that could be an anthology miniseries, that could be a feature film intercutting three or four of the best stories and let them all climax with them triumphing in court and showing how you can win, and yet the fight still keeps going on. I think it would be a really interesting property for somebody to pick up. However, that's all complicated and difficult. The easy pick this week is The Driver by Hart Hansen. He's the guy who created Bones, the longest running hit drama in Fox history. It's a thriller, so that makes it an easy pick. It's about a retired military guy who runs a limo service, and his company is filled with employees who were veterans or even the Afghan translator that he had that he brought to America because he became friends with him. So he's babysitting this big guy who's a skateboarding mogul, this teenager. Somebody tries to kill the kid. He has to save his life, and then they're on the run trying to figure out what's going on. If that sounds like an easy pick. So if you're picking all those four movies, I'm imagining they're going to go for The Driver right away.
Well, here's a question. Will it be confused with Baby Driver? No, actually, my question is James Comey. Remember him? You know,
I remember him, sure.
I think actually, you know how every year the Oxford English Dictionary says, you know, this is the word of the year. It might be James Comey this year because his name has been said so much in the media. He's the former FBI director who was fired earlier this year by President Trump. He has a book deal now with Flatiron. He's going to write a book about, I guess, his life and his time at the FBI and working in government. And it's going to be out in spring 2018, to which I ask, wow, you know, you sometimes hear about books selling in like April of 2016 and they're not published until the very end of 2017 or January of 2018. And you go, why did it take so long? You sold the book. It was already written. And yet it took, you know, to get it to galleys and proofread and you know how long it takes to get some of these books out. This guy, he's writing the book and, you know, two minutes later, it's being published. What is the deal there?
Well, it's not 2 minutes later, but it's 8 months, true. 9 months. That's pretty fast. But to put it in perspective, the catalogs for spring 2018 are already out. The publishers have already sent out the catalogs detailing their big books for spring of 2018. So that is pretty quick, relatively speaking. The only reason it's not coming out faster is because he has to write the darn thing. But frankly, it would be news only if he didn't write a book.
Right. So
everybody involved is writing a book. But yes, they are moving faster. They're doing a good job. They're going to get it out before the fall elections in 2018. That's clearly what they have their eye on.
Do you think that James Comey himself will be writing it, or will it be told to kind of thing?
I assume it'll be told to, but you never know. Maybe he's a writer.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, hey, if he wins a Pulitzer Prize for it, that would be interesting.
It would even be a big deal.
Oh, thank you very much. That was a softball. Come on.
Yeah.
It's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, Kanye West. He is not happy. You might remember earlier this year, or actually, was it late last year? In any case, he was on tour and doing spectacularly well. Until suddenly, he began to go off on rambling political speeches, confusing and annoying fans who came to hear him sing and weren't thrilled when he said he didn't vote, but would have voted for Trump. You know, just Kanye being Kanye. Beyond his politics, West seemed troubled, to say the least. Toss in a very upsetting criminal attack on his wife in Paris, you might recall that, and Kanye seemed to be spiraling out of control. In fact, he had a breakdown and was admitted to a hospital for care, canceling the rest of his tour. Now West is suing his insurers because instead of making good on the very expensive insurance he paid for, West's lawyers say they immediately took an aggressive and antagonistic stance that ignored what was best for Kanye's mental health and were determined to deny coverage for any reason they could find. Now, all parties are going to court. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. We just saw Justin Bieber cancel some shows. You know, how you justify that and who has to pay the price is a big question. We watched Kanye West on stage, just as in the past we watched, you know, Amy Winehouse and other people on stage who seem to be having actual breakdowns and not becoming, you know, stable or safe. And you thought, my God, I hope somebody helps them get help. And he did that. And some of the court documents reveal he really was in bad, really did have a mental breakdown, which good for him to let that come out. And the insurer doesn't want to pay it. I don't know the legal ramifications. I don't know how you justify it or not justify it, but he's doing what's smart for his long-term career, and that's what insurance is for. So my sympathy in this case is with him.
Yeah, and it'll be the promoters, actually, that probably had the coverage, but in this case, he might be the promoter. And I do remember, Michael, vividly, the Amy Winehouse, her last public concert.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, because of YouTube, this was out within... Yeah, I think it was in like Croatia or Serbia, somewhere in the former Yugoslavia. And, you know, it was around the world within 48 hours. And she was obviously intoxicated, couldn't remember the words, couldn't stand up straight. And I just remember thinking, oh my God, somebody has to help her because she is incapable of helping herself. And within, I think, 4 months, she was dead.
Mm-hmm.
I hope incidents like that, if they're good for anything, they remind artists, hey, I need to know when to say when.
Which is why it's good for Justin Bieber to have pulled the plug after adding a couple shows to his tour.
Exactly. Hopefully their agents would actually step in, but that's my way of moving us along to our next story. The talent agency WMEIMG, William Morris, they keep getting bigger. They've been on a buying spree, acquiring everything from the UFC franchise to Michael's favorite, the Professional Bull Riders Association, to the Miss Universe pageant, with new investors stepping up to invest more than $1 billion. That takes the total value of the company to more than $6.3 billion. Will WME keep getting bigger or use this money to exploit the many platforms they already have? What's the money for? Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I'm not sure. I mean, why did they need this $1 billion? Did they need it because they've overextended themselves, or they have more expansion plans, or they want to, you know, start bringing to fruition the platforms they've developed? I just don't know. And I couldn't gather any info about what their idea is and why they took this money and what they want to do with it.
Well, the key here and the clue here might be in the headline. And when they say $1 billion cash infusion, meaning we needed the cash to pay people, to, as opposed to $1 billion cash investment. Those are two different things. One, we're
invested. Well, they didn't choose the words, though, for the headline. So that's true. That's a Hollywood Reporter choosing the word.
That's true. I'm just saying it might be. And, you know, that might be. But yes, like you, I'm like, well, why do they need the money? Are they going to buy something else? Probably not at this point. They're probably a little overextended. They might be using it to buy down some debt. So
Paramount Pictures could use a little money too.
Yeah, indeed. They actually, you might recall, we've kind of talked about, you know, a Chinese company investing some money in them for their slate of movies. Except there's one problem with that, Michael. You know, Viacom has had all this trouble, right? You know, and Paramount Pictures is owned by Viacom. The problem here is that the Chinese company didn't pay the first installment.
Oopsie.
Yeah. So Paramount,
they were supposed to get $1 billion in cash over 3 years.
Correct.
And then the Chinese company delayed. They said, who's in charge here? We want to know who's in charge before we hand over our money. And they had big meetings and they flew to China. And then the government in China said, we're sending too much money overseas. We're clamping down on that. So now what's happened? They're just not getting any money at all.
Well, yes, although the company that is supposed to be giving the money, Huahua Media, is saying, look, it has nothing to do with currency controls in China. It's that we have no idea what we're investing in. Okay, so what's going on at Paramount? Your movies aren't doing very well. In fact, what, you've had like two movies, one of which was Transformers, which everybody's considering a disappointment, despite the fact that it has made nearly $1 billion?
It hasn't. It's made $600 million. Okay, it's not even close to $1 billion.
Well, okay. Nitpicks.
Big difference. What was the name of this company?
Huahua. What did you say? Huahua Media.
I thought for some reason you were making like the peanut sound of like whatever people are talking. Wah, wah. And I thought that's what you said. Then I realized, oh, you're saying the name of a company. My apologies to the billion people in China.
Yes. Well, I don't know what's going on here other than the fact that Paramount needs some money. They need to make some movies. They're not getting it from the Chinese investor they thought they were getting it from. They say they're still going to get it from that Chinese investor, and we'll see what happens.
That's right. Well, you know, bad news for Paramount, but good news for Justin Bieber, right? He pulled out of his tour and he's part of a hit song.
That's true. Although this next story, believe it or not, has very little to do with Justin Bieber. The smash hit song Despacito, we talked about it a couple times in the past couple of episodes. It keeps growing, and not that slowly. The Luis Fonsi Daddy Yankee collaboration, with an assist from Justin Bieber, to be sure, continues to dominate the world charts after becoming the most streamed song of all time. It is even its... Yeah, there you go. A little copyright infringement along with our episode today.
Fair use.
Yeah. what did you say it's an honor of.
That's right. It's an homage.
So the song has even inspired political commentary exploring what it means in the age of Trump for a song like this that draws on several languages and musical styles that span the globe. And now it has set another record. YouTube announced it's the first video in history to pass 3 billion views on the platform. So it's not only the most streamed video of all time, it is the first video to pass 3 billion views. Big deal or big whoop.
It's a big deal. It just shows how streaming is where it's at, and that will survive for a few weeks until the next video passes it or Adele releases her album 30.
Now, yeah, keep in mind, video was released January 12th. Justin Bieber not in the video, by the way. It's not that version.
They're adding up both versions. No, they're adding up both the version with Justin Bieber doing a line as well, I believe.
Okay.
Perhaps I'm wrong, but that's my understanding that the you know.
No, actually they're not. Yeah. No, it's just this one video that was posted January 12th, and they kind of made a point in saying it's not the Justin Bieber version.
Well, but that really helped power the hit too. So,
oh, absolutely.
Yeah. They've been very, yeah. Okay.
And remember like last week I was like, I've never even heard this song. Remember that? Like how uncool I am.
Yeah.
So I pick up my daughter from soccer practice and turn on the radio, and there the song is on, and she's singing along with it. I'm like, you know this song? And she's like, yeah, it's Despacito. I'm like, oh my God, I'm so old.
I was in a bar in St. Pete, and the guy made a point of saying, it's the number one song in the world, or in the country, actually, is what he said at the time, because it was the number one song in North America. But there you go. That's a big hit for you.
Well, you talked about Wonder Woman earlier, Michael, but Wonder Woman can only do so much, folks. She's fighting Nazis in her debut film and partnering with Justice League in the fall. It's not her fault she can't also defeat the way films are made. A new USC study says the gender gap in Hollywood, both in front of and behind the camera, is not getting any better. A data analysis of thousands of scripts and other points of info find women characters tend to be 5 years younger than the men and often not important to the plot. They also have to listen to a lot of mansplaining, okay? And that's not manscaping, okay? There's a difference. And the reason that is men dominate dialogue. Women aren't quite as far behind when it comes to producing, and they dominate casting. But that's about it for good news. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop.
What?
Because we knew this already. And if they make those four projects I mentioned in the book filter section, if they make The Driver, as far as I can tell, there are no female characters. And if there are, they'll probably be like girlfriend or wife.
Now, this next story cost me an hour of my life.
And me an hour of my life.
Yes, because you thought the Broadway show The Great Comet suffered when Josh Groban left. Well, Hello, Dolly has to brace for the departure of star Bette Midler. It features a tremendous cast, including David Hyde Pierce and Gavin Creel, and two-time Tony winner Donna Murphy getting raves as the Tuesday night Dolly. Okay, she plays Dolly on Tuesday nights. But it's all about Bette, and they're going to need some flashy announcement to keep the show going. As for maintaining its current stratospheric level of sales, well, that's probably not happening. And Michael, as you and I figured out last night, it's definitely not going to happen. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. We knew Bette Midler wasn't going to stay in the show forever. So, you know, they'll pick Queen Latifah or somebody to do their Broadway debut or some big name that'll work. And it won't be the same level. But I think they can keep the show running for a while because it's a perfect part for an actress of a certain age. It's easy to sing and do to a certain degree. And, you know, they'll keep it going. They just got to find the right person. But clearly, this was a phenomenon. But, you know, big stars keep coming to Broadway. Amy Schumer's coming to Broadway. She's starring in a new play written by Steve Martin. She's going to star alongside Keegan-Michael Key, Laura Benanti, and Alan Tudyk. It's a romantic drama called Meteor Shower that opens up in November.
Well, and Bette Midler will be leaving in January of 2018 from Hello, Dolly. And I said, Michael, is this the time I should, like, race to New York to you know, finally see Bette Midler on Broadway in Hello, Dolly? And you said, absolutely, if you have $1,000.
And don't care about spending the money.
Right.
Yeah, if you're going to go to the show and say, that wasn't worth $500, don't go.
Well, and I said, come on, Michael, come on. It can't possibly cost that much. And then you and I spent the next like 40 minutes online at the Schubert Theater website and SeatGuru and all these ticket sites, right, finding tickets for sale. And I said, look, Michael, front row mezzanine. November 5th. And you were like, that can't possibly be true. And I was arguing with you. I said, no, that's right there. I can see it. Should I buy the tickets? I only have 10 minutes before they give them back to the group, you know, back to the box office. And you said, that can't be correct. And we fought about it for 10 minutes. And sure enough, turns out, yeah, that's a date that, you know, Bette Midler is not performing.
That's right. It was November 4th, actually, because it was the 1st to the 4th of November.
Right.
But anyway, yeah, you can't find cheap tickets to Hello, Dolly. It's not going to happen.
Well, TV icon Norman Lear has devoted his career to progressive issues, creating TV shows that became huge hits while tackling topics ranging from rape and mixed marriage to gays, the rights of women, abortion, and much more. So it's no surprise that after shows like All in the Family, Maude, The Jeffersons, and so many more, that Lear would receive a Kennedy Center honor. In fact, one would think he'd already had a couple of them. It's even less surprising that the Trump-denouncing TV producer would boycott the current president. He'll skip the White House reception rather than walk a line to shake hands with the man who thought Archie Bunker made a lot of sense. And he says, quote, I am honored to accept the award. I could not respect the arts and humanities more. And I could not be more honored to be in the company that are being honored. But I will not be going to the White House. No word yet on whether Lionel Richie, Gloria Estefan, or LL Cool J, all of whom are being honored, will follow suit.
They're also being honored alongside Carmen de Lavallade, who is a great dancer choreographer, but it took me forever to hear online how to pronounce her name, Lavallade. I spent like 10 minutes tracking that down. But yeah, you know, I think what he did was great. I thought initially he just wasn't going to go because he didn't want to be in the same room with Trump. But in fact, he said, no, it's an honor. I will go to the ceremony. I'll be on the TV thing. Trump and his wife and family possibly will be in the presidential box. They will be there watching the show, as the president always is. Streisand showed up when Bush was president, when she got a Kennedy Center honor. And, you know, Lear said, I'm not going to spurn him. If he approaches me and wants to talk to me afterwards, you know, I'm not going to ignore him. Gloria Estefan said, actually, I'm going to the White House. I'm going to shake his hand, and I'm going to use that opportunity to tell him how much immigrants have done for this country. So, you know, good. I think it's the appropriate level. You're respecting the office and the honor without, you know, doing something you think is, you know, showing up early so you can shake his hand, you know. I think it's the right level of engagement. As for
And he puts his mind, you know, he puts his money where his mouth is in regards to honoring, you know, arts and the humanities. He went to see The Cake just a few days before I did. He was there in the audience, and it's 99-seat theater. He does not necessarily have to be seeking this stuff out. But he obviously, unlike myself, read the reviews and read the press on it and went to go see it.
Yeah. And as for LL Cool J, seems like a really nice guy. Everybody who works with him likes him. God bless him for his career in NCIS Los Angeles and rap music. But, you know, why is he getting the Kennedy Center honor? I'm not quite sure why.
I don't know
why. He's the first rapper to get a Kennedy Center honor. Well, that's not the one they should have chosen.
Okay. Well, you know.
Sorry, I don't mean to pick on him, but, you know, that's, you know, it's just not appropriate.
Well, it's a new drama spun off from an alternate history of post-Civil War America. And
no, you're
not listening to last week's show, in which it seems like we kind of covered that story. No, this time it involves prominent Black creative talent as executive producers and key players in the drama, in the television show. And yet, unlike HBO's drama, Confederate, the announcement of Amazon's Black America, that's the title, was met with praise, or at least no derision, and no launching of a hashtag campaign to denounce it. Why? The main faces behind the show aren't the white guys behind Game of Thrones. That's why. Also, the setup of the show is akin to Amazon's The Man in the White Castle. Unlike Confederate, which imagined slavery still existed in the U.S., Black America imagines Black Americans received Louisiana, Alabama, and Mississippi as reparations for slavery, and they have dubbed it New Colonia. The talent behind the show is producer Will Packer and Boondocks creator Aaron Magruder. Here's my only complaint about this story. Can we name it something else other than New Colonia? Big deal or big whoop.
Well, I don't think that's not the name of the show.
Right. I know. But, you know.
I think it's a big whoop. You know, TV series is announced. However, I love Aaron Magruder. I really like the comic strip Boondocks. The TV show was occasionally brilliant. The Boondocks cartoon TV series. So he's a really interesting talent, a really smart guy. Unlike the HBO series, I'm excited to see this one, but I remain bemused and annoyed at people's attitudes towards how dare white people make it. It's like young people should write about old people. Women should write about men. People in the present day should write about people in the 1400s. Black people should write about white people. White people should write about Asian. It's like the art is an act of empathy, and that's only a good thing. And if people do it poorly, they'll get called out on it. So don't worry. You know, you can't write a novel about noble savages. You know, people are going to say, excuse me, you don't even know the difference between a Navajo and Arapaho. So, you know, do your homework. And people will expect you to do your homework. But the idea that people are forbidden to do it is frightening and scary and not a really great way to engender empathy and understanding, much less keep pushing the idea that race means something other than a social construct. Either it's a fake idea, a social construct, or it's not. So, you know, on the other hand, Detroit wasn't very good, and that was directed by a white woman.
Now, there is an easy way to always know the difference between a Navajo and Arapaho. Just keep in mind, Navajo always begins with the letter N.
Don't. Oh, okay.
And Arapaho always begins with the letter A. That's the way you tell the difference.
Ah, there you go. Very well done. I was waiting for a really bad joke.
No, just, you know, Navajo N. Arapaho A.
It was a bad joke, but it wasn't a racist joke.
As opposed to all of my good jokes? Does Netflix want to become a multimedia empire? Do they? Well, they've just made their first acquisition in the company's history, which is kind of shocking. Comic book publisher Miller World. That's the company behind a bunch of successful properties, including Kick-Ass, Wanted, and Kingsman, which, by the way, has a sequel coming out in the fall. Adam Aaron of AMC Theaters, he highly recommends it.
I'm really looking forward to seeing it.
He actually did say, you know, hey, go see that movie. Creator Mark, I want to say this is Mark Millar, but maybe it's Mark Miller, will be spinning off movies, TV series, and kid shows all through the Netflix label. Miller has also created other hit comic book titles, and during his 8 years at Marvel, wrote story arcs that inspired the recent hits Captain America, Civil War, and Logan. So if they can be half as good, We're in for some good stuff. Big deal, big whoop.
It's a big deal. It's an interesting new move for Netflix, isn't it? And there aren't a lot of big comic book properties. He seems to have enough titles in his franchise in his catalog to make it worthwhile. They had no mention on what the dollar value was, but you know, Warner Brothers bought DC in 1968. Disney didn't buy Marvel until 2009. So, you know, those are the two monsters. But there are others out there, like Dark Horse and so on. So they're few and far between. We'll have to be interested to see if there becomes a race for people to snap up some of the others.
It takes a long time to add up all those books. But the Association of American Publishers has gathered final numbers from some 1,800 publishers and estimates for the rest, presumably including Amazon, by the way. In 2016, the entire book industry fell 5% in sales to $26.2 billion. Mind you, this figure includes academic sales, professional publishing sales, that is sales to like libraries for journals and the like, and more. It includes more than just, say, trade sales. Because if you look at trade sales, which, Michael, is the books you and I purchase at bookstores and online, sales were actually up in 2016, hitting just a smidge under $16 billion. You know, what's $100 million between friends anyway? Most categories were up except fiction. And Michael will be frustrated to hear that ebook grosses, they dropped for the third year in a row. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. In fiction, it's good that in the trade world, it's good that sales went up. Nonfiction was up. Kids' books were up. Religion was up. Fiction was the one category that dropped. Ebook, by the way, remains the most popular format for adult fiction. It's 33% of all sales. That's bigger than hardcover, trade paperback, mass market, audiobooks, you name it. So it's the most popular one. And if they just didn't price it out of the market, they'd be growing sales in ebooks as well. And audiobook is up hugely as well. That's up 20% 2016 over 2015. But there's two big warning signs for the overall book industry, and that is the academic area and the library area, because there's going to be come hell to pay soon, because in academics, schools around the country are going to start adapting open source textbooks. Why do you need to pay for a textbook for a third grade, you know, math class or a fourth grade English class? They should be open source, they should be digital, and they should be free. And they're going to be pretty soon. Cities and states are starting to do that. I don't see how they can ever stop it. So there's going to be a big drop in the $7 billion market that includes academic publishing. Same thing with libraries. They are churning out money for all these academic journals, you know, $1,000 a year, $2,000 a year for the journal on butterflies or whatever. And they felt they had to. But now there's a big push. All the universities say, hey, we're funding this research. That research should be free to everyone. And the libraries are saying, we don't have any money, so we can't buy these journals anymore. So that's, you know, a big market, and $7 billion of it is in academics and libraries, and that's going to take a big, big hit in the years to come.
Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week, and it moves us along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this week, how will all of this affect you? Well, time will tell, but it's all about television, how you get it, who gives it to you, how much it costs, and whether some of it should be free. Now,
so Sperling, I want to know, because you brought up this article from The New Yorker that talks about cable and how it's a monopoly and people hate cable companies and they're paying higher and higher prices and everybody's angry. What made you think this was something we should talk about? Because to me, I'm like, don't we know all this?
Well, yes, you and I know this, and most people in the entertainment industry know this, and most people in business know this, but now it's trickling down to, say, residents of Lexington, Kentucky, who are opening their mail and going, wait, why did my cable bill all of a sudden go up from $90 to $139 literally 1 month to the next? So, yes, I agree with you, Michael. As far as a story goes, it's a story that we have all heard before.
Including Middle America. Middle America hates cable companies. Hates them. They hate their cable bill. It's too high. They hate cable companies. They think they're paying too much money. It's a nightmare.
But it's stemming originally from urban areas. Now, you're right, it's making it to more rural areas and Middle America areas. And the story kind of focuses on Lexington, Kentucky, because that's where Time Warner Cable merged with Charter Communications, mm-hmm. and they formed Spectrum. And basically, Spectrum is like, I don't know, man, that's the new price. You're just going to have to deal with it. And it goes on to talk about all the things we've discussed in the past about how there are these regional monopolies. But Lexington, Kentucky, all of a sudden, the mayor's office actually has had to dedicate a person to field complaints from citizens about cable bills. And they keep a spreadsheet with who's complained about what. And the mayor is saying, look, there's not much we can do about this. And this news story is beginning to say, look, Ajit Pai over at the FCC, this is a story that you need to be paying attention to, not just people in business, not just people in the entertainment space or the tech space. This is a story that will affect Americans of all stripes, and it's not good for consumers. So before all of a sudden you find out, well, why did my cable bill go up? When did this FCC ruling happen? Much the way it did in the 2000s under the George W. Bush administration, now is the time to be paying attention to it. So that's why I highlighted this story. It also helps explain maybe why Dish Network lost 200,000 subscribers in the second quarter.
Right. Well, you're saying it's going to get worse because of Ajay Pai, because of net neutrality?
Well, right. Basically, net neutrality and some of the other things. Like, for instance, remember all the talking we did about set-top boxes and how it was about time that set-top boxes just went away and there should be a rule that, cable companies should just allow any set-top box? And that
right. That was going to save us, what, how many billions of dollars a year?
$20 billion a year is what cable companies make on that. And he came in.
On set-top box rental.
Right. And yes. he came in and said, yeah, we're killing that that regulation. Less regulation is better.
There's been 10,000. This is not a new article. There's no new information in here. And in fact, what I don't understand is why more big businesses aren't angry and up in arms. Because other than the three monopolies, every big business is affected by net neutrality in ways large and small about how they do business and communicate with customers. And they should be petrified that they're going to have to pay money to gatekeepers to get their word out, to get their websites out, to communicate to So every company other than these cable monopolies should be freaking out and angrily storming Washington saying, you better keep net neutrality.
Right. I mean, effectively, right now you have AT&T in the U.S. trying to buy Time Warner, which owns Warner Brothers Studios and, you know, the CW. And basically what would happen there is AT&T has all, you know, they're basically a big cable provider and a big internet provider. And what they could say to every Comcast customer is, hey, well, not necessarily Comcast customer, but to Netflix and YouTube and every other content provider for content that they themselves do not own, meaning non-Time Warner content, they could turn around and say, well, we have, let's say, 50 million subscribers to our internet service, and if you want to reach those people, you have to pay us a premium. Unless it's our content, unless it's Time Warner content, in which case we can reach those people, you know, fast and
have a competitive advantage.
The fact that they would get rid of net neutrality and then allow big mergers such as AT&T, Time Warner, the two do not jive. The two, it just makes no sense. So if you're going to allow Comcast to buy NBC Universal, okay, fine. Then put some regulation in place that says Comcast, which provides access for customers and to customers of the internet, you can't gatekeep.
Or don't allow the merger in the first place.
That was my argument way back before 2011, as you know.
But don't worry about what might happen. Let's look at what is happening. I'm actually a Spectrum customer here in Birmingham, Alabama. The house I'm staying in right now, Spectrum customer, they're going digital. Yay! They can offer us a lot more services and stuff that we don't want. But hey, we're going digital. What does that mean? It means the two TVs in the bedroom that just plug a cable coaxial line into the TV directly? No. Now you need a cable box. So instead of having one cable box, we're going to need three cable boxes, which means they've just tripled our cable box price per month. So rather than just buying three cable boxes and being done for 5 years or longer, we now have to pay rental on three boxes rather than one. So that's tripled. And I thought, oh, that's really annoying. And I thought, well, at least my mom will now have a DVR in her bedroom because now she's going to have a cable box there and pay a monthly fee.
No.
That's an extra $15 a month for the second cable box in the bedroom.
Yeah.
Just for DVR.
Yeah, no, believe me.
That's outrageous.
I have a cable box sitting here on a TV from 1996. I mean, this TV is a tube TV. It is so old. It's like beyond old, okay? I probably should not be using this television anymore. And the cable box that hooks up to it is newer than the television, and it can't, you know, the cable box is kind of outpacing the television.
I'm sure. Yeah, well, you mentioned Dish Network. They lost about 200,000 subscribers in the second quarter. That's usually the worst quarter of the year for all the T-Pay TV providers.
The churn.
Right?
Yeah.
The churn, right? They're not alone. AT&T had a record loss of 350,000 subscribers, and other people did poorly. Overall, about 940,000 people ditched traditional pay TV in the second quarter. But that's not really accurate. About half of them immediately signed up for non-traditional pay TV. Some 470,000 of them latched onto Hulu, YouTube, Sling TV, and other skinny bundles, apparently for the first time. So that drop in 900,000, it's really more like a drop in 500,000. That's a lot, but that's certainly half of what they're reporting. So, you know, when people ditch one pay service for another, I don't know if that counts as, you know, like losing people. You know, like if you switch from cable to satellite, they're still a paying customer. And yeah, they're paying less, but they're still paying for TV.
Yes, but I would argue this, because I agree with the sentiment there that, yes, you're still paying for TV, guys. Okay. Now you're paying for less TV because you're
not cutting the cord.
You're using another cord, a different cord. But here's where I would argue that it does matter, because you're using a different cord from a different provider. So all of these, you know, Spectrum and Comcast and AT&T and all of these, you know, cable providers and satellite providers, they have us over a barrel because they have a monopoly on the area, right? They on a geographic area. However,
and that's ending.
And it, yes, if you basically say, I am cutting the cord to you, AT&T, or to you, Comcast, because I have no other person to actually get my TV from. Oh, wait, I do. I can go to Hulu. Now, I don't get as many channels, but I get the channels that I need and want. Okay. Then all of a sudden, Comcast, AT&T, all these providers have to actually do something called customer service. They actually have to provide a product that isn't poor. They have to.
So are your fears over lack of competition, you know, unreasonable, since they do have all this new competition now forming?
I think we're in a gray zone right now where the question is, and this is why. I've talked to numerous people, not in the industry. They're just, you know, when I'm in travels, everybody's saying, I just want to cut my cable cord, but I don't know. Do I get Hulu? Do I get Netflix? I don't know which one has the channels that I need or want. Right now, that gray area is we don't know where to turn or which service is going to be best for us. That will change. Eventually, people will figure it out, or somebody will provide a service that says, don't worry, we'll do this for you. Here's the 50 channels you want. Give us the $50 per month. And you're done.
And millennials have figured out an awesome hack of how to get access to actual broadcast TV channels for free, haven't they?
Yes, this is the greatest story. It was in the Wall Street Journal. And yes, the TV antenna is making a comeback, just like vinyl LPs. TV viewers who cut the cord or never paid for cable in the first place, these millennials, they realize they can access major TV networks, get this, Michael, for free. Now, you and I knew that. Right?
We did.
Antennas can cost maybe like, what, $20? And as long as you're not in a big city, they pretty much work as well as always and make a great addition to anyone who is paying for Netflix, let's say, or Hulu and or HBO Go, any of these skinny bundles where they may not have the local stations. They may not have CBS, NBC, ABC, the local evening news. Of course, now we also discover an increase in millennials falling off their roofs while trying to find a good signal, but that's another story entirely.
Now, isn't there a transfer to digital only, and that won't the analog signal be turned off at some point? Isn't that what the antennas reach, or do antennas reach the digital signal as well?
Antennas reach the digital signal, and here's a little secret. When you have cable or satellite, you're getting a signal that is, let's say, 4 megabit per second. It's been compressed to between 4 and 6 megabit per second, so you know, that's how much data is being sent to you for you to view, whether it's ESPN or CNN. When you get over the air, okay, you're getting roughly 18 megabit per second. Okay, so that's what's being broadcast over the air to an antenna, a digital antenna. So you're actually getting better quality when you're using an antenna, at least for the local stations, for any station that can be broadcast over the air.
Mm-hmm. When I love this, Nielsen, of course, everybody wants Nielsen to track people who watch TV shows in a bar or in the dorm, you know, the dorm lounge of a college. You know, there's all that viewing that takes place away from your own personal television set. And they've got a new metric for it. They've now dubbed it the out of home viewing, or OOH, or ooh. And they found that ooh is increasing a lot. Ooh, look at that. People watch TV in bars and in airport lounges and stuff like that. It's growing a lot. People are watching multiple hours a week outside of the home. Millennials do it a lot. Older people do it a lot. It's happening all over the place, and they want to track it.
Yeah. Now, before we get off the antenna thing, I just have to say one thing, because I know you want to move on to Nielsen, but The funniest part of this story, okay, is that the guy who wrote the legislation for broadcasters to switch from analog to digital signals in 2009, his own son didn't realize that antennas could still get television.
Yeah, that still works.
Yeah, he's like, I thought, Dad, you should know better than anybody. Those antennas don't work anymore. And he was like, yeah, they do. It's just, and the best part to me, Karen Bass, a Democrat from California, a congresswoman, okay, she didn't know that broadcast television could be had over the air. And then when that got out, a representative for, a spokesperson for Representative Bass said she was aware that TV antennas existed, just not that the station was still broadcast during a cable blackout, because she was talking about like when cable.
So maybe there was a reason that all of it would be out, not just cable.
Yeah, I'm like, and that is an example of your spin being worse and making you look worse than the actual infraction. You should have just said, left it alone. But in any case, no matter how people are watching, Michael, you're right. Everybody's trying to measure who's watching, how they're watching, where they're watching. And you have been saying for quite some time, look, if you're going to give us the overnights, okay, fine, you're giving us the overnights. But give us how many people ultimately watched a particular episode on a particular day.
Beat the drum for the best news that you have. Why keep it a secret?
Right. And beat it again and again. Do live plus 7, live plus 20, live plus 30. And then maybe at some point you kind of trail off, but give us the ultimate viewer count for a particular episode on a particular date. Well, guess who agrees with you, Michael? You'll never believe. Bob Greenblatt of NBC. Now, that would, if you're not familiar with who Bob Greenblatt is, the reason this is kind of important news is he actually is the head of NBC.
And he's at the TCA, which is an annual convention where TV critics meet with all the major networks and cable channels, and they all do dog and pony shows for the upcoming season and what they're excited about. And then they got to take questions and answer stuff about why did you move this show to this time slot? And what about that show? And why did you cancel this? And why aren't you canceling that? So then, you know, you get a lot of news made during the TCA.
Right. And it's, you know, held in Pasadena out of the Four Seasons. Yeah. I mean, it's always an interesting time for news.
And what did Greenblatt say?
He said, stop quoting overnights, people. Stop doing that. To which, you know, both Michael and I immediately thought, okay, but that's all you give us, right? I mean, we don't have anything else to go on, so maybe...
Yeah, he said he wishes reporters would stop focusing so much on overnight ratings. He said their hit drama, This Is Us, has averaged 26 million viewers when all is said and done for every episode. The pilot's been seen by 32 million people. That's amazing. That brings it right up to, you know, we knew it was the biggest network hit. I didn't know it was quite that big. And that's the stuff I look out for. That puts it in the level of Game of Thrones, you know, which one's bigger.
And NFL football during the fall.
Yeah, those are. And he said, you know, I'd love for the live same day ratings to be the proverbial dinosaur as opposed to the broadcast network. He said, stop reporting them so much. And I'm like, I'm with you, brother. Just, you know, I'm begging the trades. I beg other people like Programming Insider, Mark Berman. We've had him on the show. I beg USA Today. I say, why are you doing a chart of the primetime schedule? What's on at 8 and 8:30? Nobody watches TV that way anymore. Give us the top 50 shows of the day. I don't care what channel they're on. I don't care daytime, nighttime, primetime. Just, you know, give us a list of the top 50 shows. You'll cover everything down to like less than a million. You know, we don't need a chart with 1,000 shows because we know there's so many shows on TV. But we can't report on it if you don't tell us what the facts are. And you're not going to have that a day after the show airs. You're going to have to wait 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month. But that's okay. The live plus 7 ratings can be big news. And the live 14, oh my God, we're growing more. Live plus 20, look, more people are watching the show. It's another chance to gain publicity for your shows. But the information is not available even in the trades. Forget the general public, even in the trades. I had no idea This Is Us was being watched by 26 million people. That should be bigger news.
Well, and I know for some of our listeners in Europe and in Australia and in other countries around the world, you're saying, oh my God, I just had to sit through listening to Michael and Sperling once again bitch and moan about, you know, cable providers and internet.
Well, the same is true for the BBC and how many people watch Downton Abbey or The Crown or whatever.
I'm talking about the internet access and the legislation around internet access and television access. I know that. And we say this, and I say this because I want to remind you how lucky you are that you have competition, because it does matter. I mean, you're getting 100 megabit per second down and sometimes up on your internet service provider, and your your images, when I go to Europe, I love watching television because the images are crystal clear because they're not being compressed.
They get better coverage, better service, better internet, better TV for less money than we do in North America.
Right. Well, I should say they're not being compressed as much. But yes. Mm. So thank you for bearing with us during our rant.
And we apologize for beating a dead horse, but that brings us to obituaries.
Oh my gosh.
Is that a bad segue? Yeah. Okay. Well, this is a fascinating person. Judith Jones. She is a legendary book editor. She died at 93. She was really a giant. When she was an intern, like I think she was in Europe, and she saw the slush pile of rejected books, not the books that they were whatever were sent over the transom, but books that said we're not going to do. And she found a book, The Diary of Anne Frank, and she read it while her boss was out at lunch. He came back and she says her tears were streaming down her face. She just picked it up because of the photo on the cover, because the cover matters. And she said, oh my God, you have to release it. He's like, what, the book about the kid? She's like, oh my God, yes. And they sent it to New York and they did the English translation. It had already been published in other countries, but that obviously became a huge book. But that was far from her only accomplishment. She did Julia Child's Mastering the Art of French Cooking, and she was the person who made that happen, really. And then that made her a real force in cookbooks. She published cookbooks by James Beard and countless others, and she also edited a lot of big authors like John Updike, did virtually all of his books, Anne Tyler, John Hershey, and two of my favorite authors of all time, William Maxwell and Peter Taylor. I've interviewed Peter Taylor. He's dead now. A wonderful Southern writer, great short story novelist, and William Maxwell, just a great novelist and short story writer. So Long, See You Tomorrow is his masterpiece, a short novel, really heartbreaking and beautiful. But she had a long, long career. Cookbooks, memoirs, major writers, she did it all.
Well, I wonder what book she didn't do of John Updike.
I forget, but I think it even mentioned there was just one book for some reason she didn't work on. It might have been something onto the side or something. They just made a point of saying she did all these books but one. You know, they couldn't say she did all of them because there was one that maybe she was on vacation. I don't know. But, you know, the Julia Child book, it doesn't get bigger than that. That really changed cookbook publishing for, you know, a generation. It doesn't say which John Updike book, at least in the Times obituary.
Yes, well, you know, I think that... you know, it's interesting because when this story broke, okay, there were a bunch of executives at all these publishing houses who went, what is this job editor? What does that do? but yes, her time, well, much like editors and the position of editor at publishing houses has kind of, I guess they still have editors, right?
They do. People who edit books and acquire books. There's a much less of actual copy editing. It depends on the book and the publisher and the author. But yeah, there's a lot less of that going on. Certainly no fact checking, no copy editing to the level it used to be. So yeah, it's a whole different world.
Yeah. It will be a different world without Judith Jones, who unfortunately passed away and her time with us came to an end. And now our time with you is coming to an end. That is the end of our show for this week. But remember, you can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can subscribe to our show. You can rate and review our show and tell other listeners how great our show is. Please do subscribe to the show and rate and review the show. It does help us out when you do that. That information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find ways to contact us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can find us on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our username. Or a handle on Showbiz Sandbox. You can like us on Facebook. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox and our page should come up. Links to all of the stories on today's episode can be found where you can find all of that contact information, which is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week, it's WolfWarrior3TheMovie.com.
which I think you're
there's
being...
There's going to be a sequel, so I might as well try and make some money.
You're being sued for it right now, I'm sure. If you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry on that website, why not head on over to the Huffington Post or michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, don't forget to check out bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.